Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Jim and Austin. Recently, current administration announced that combat operations were over in Iraq, and there's been a lot of changes there. Have combat operations really ended, Jim?
Well, not really. The 50,000 troops that are still there were basically rebranded. We did a piece on this, I think, last week. There's at least five combat brigades which were reorganized and retrained as advise and, you know, assist brigades. And they're basically smaller versions of the normal combat brigade, which can run over 4,000 troops. These are a little smaller. And they are basically out there in small teams advising, you know, battalions and brigade staffs and things like that. They can get into a fight, but they're not out looking for, you know, a fight. There was an incident the other day that was in the news about a terrorist raid on an army base, and American troops happened to be nearby, and they just opened up, you know, to help out. So technically, the combat brigade, the advise and assist brigades, are not there to fight, but to advise and assist. And this actually started last year. They sent their first one over to see how the new organization worked. This is basically just a continuation of the, you know, the advise and assist thing that goes back, you know, before Vietnam. It was in Korea 50 years ago when the North Koreans invaded. And in addition to that, there are two National Guard infantry brigades, but they're simply there to provide security for the remaining bases. There's nearly 100 bases still remaining. And then there are two aviation brigades, which are there mainly for transportation, but some of those helicopters are armed. So technically, all combat troops who are supposed to be just fighting are out.
All right. Now, what about special operations?
Most of them, not all of them, have shifted to Afghanistan. I think a year ago, it was like 70% of the special forces, special operations people who were out in the field, as it were in Iraq. What was I say? 3 years ago. And 30% were in Afghanistan. Now it's reversed. So there are still some in Iraq. In fact, one of the main things that the Iraqis still depend on us for is intelligence. And some of that requires special operations. The special operations guys don't all do, you know, the Rambo stuff. A lot of them are basically very specialized information gathering guys. I mean, they can go out there, even though they're Americans, although a lot of the guys in the 5th Special Forces group are of, Middle Eastern extraction. And so they can just dress up, as it were, and slip out and basically acquire information or do it from an aircraft or whatever. Anyway, the Iraqis still depend on us for the information. One of the dicier items over there now is the Iraqis want access to all of our databases. We, in the course of the last 7 years, collected the ID, physical ID, you know, fingerprints and iris scans and what have you, DNA samples, on over 10% of the population. Now, this is the 10% of the usual suspects in the population. So we're talking about, you know, more than half of the actual or potential bad guys in the country. And the Iraqis want access to that. We're a little leery of giving it to them. You know, but they have access to it. They can say, hey, here's a print, we got whatever. You know, I got anything on this guy. But the idea of giving them everything, which is not just the ID, but also information we have on them. This is the database we've been writing about for the last, you know, 7 years. In fact, Austin, you were linked up with the Geeks with Guns when you were over there. So you ran into some of this. And that's a contentious issue because the Iraqis are bringing it up at the highest level. And to get that data, say, these are Iraqi people's information, we should have it. But we're afraid that if they have it, it'll be sold to the highest bidder and people will get killed as a result.
Right. Well, I know one of my friends just got back. He's a civilian contractor that helps run the UAVs, and he said the biggest fear of the troops right now is flipping their MRAPs. And
That's true. And well, that goes to show you the we just did a piece today on the IED campaign in Afghanistan. But in Iraq, the intelligence effort, both by us and by the Iraqis, and they have a fairly good police force, at least as far as special operations goes, you know, SWAT and detective work, they have pretty much shut down the roadside bomb weapon in Iraq. It still happens, but not to the extent, like it's more than 95% less than it was, you know, 3 years ago. So there is not the biggest, in fact, for the last year or so, the biggest complaint I've been hearing about from Iraq is the is traffic accidents. You still got a lot of guys over there who are listening to what they were told, you know, when they were in basic, you know, 2 years ago. Drive like hell, never slow down. That doesn't work anymore. If you drive like you used to in the bad old days, you're just going to cause you're going to flip your MRAP, or you're basically going to crash into Iraqis and cause a big diplomatic fuss. There is, in fact, I don't know if we've run this piece yet. There was a piece on the trend in the casualties. It's the casualty rate for the troops there, you know, adjusted for the number of troops, is like 1/6 of what it was 3 years ago. Yeah. So it's still dangerous, but not nearly as much as it used to be.
Right. Now, one of the things they still depend on us for is air support, correct?
Well, our Air Force is pulling out. That's a contentious issue. In fact, the last of the Air Force electronic warfare, you know, the Compass, whatever, you know, units, just pulled out in the last week. Apparently, they're going to keep F-16s discreetly there. But the Iraqis are hustling. I don't know if they've actually gotten an order in for their F-16. They've been talking about it for 2 years now. But they want them as soon as possible because they're basically defenseless. They were supposed to get anti-aircraft missiles. Now, the only ones we got, we got Patriot, and then we got those little jobbies, you know, the ones using the air-to-air missiles, the Army systems. The other Army systems. I've heard nothing definitive on the Iraqis actually getting something. Yeah. Again, I think we'd be leery about turning over to them Patriot systems, because basically Iraq is so corrupt. Not as bad as Afghanistan or Somalia, but they're right up there. And it's always been a contentious issue, even with the Saudis. Where, you know, corruption is not as big of an issue because there's so much money being spread around. But in Iraq, you know, everybody's out to hustle anybody they come across. And the guys over there with the advise and assist brigades are constantly coming back with new stories about, you know, the corruption. I mean, the Army has a hard time setting up a logistics system because the supplies get stolen. I mean, it's pretty blatant. And of course, the fear is that, you know, secrets are even easier to steal because you don't need a truck.
Right. Well, I was surprised that we've gone ahead and let them start using the Abrams.
Well, there are Abrams and there are Abrams. Austin, that's a much older the mark of the Abrams, isn't it?
I think that they've, you know, have they actually put them in?
Yes,
Mech, my guess is that they are a lower mark on it. You know,
I don't think they're
M1A3.
I actually saw something that they were, I think, turning over old National Guard tanks to them that were M1A1s. But
yeah,
that's still a darn good tank, man. The M1A1 is a good tank, but and it certainly outmatches anything the Iranians have. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So, of course, the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of the technology that makes the M1 so effective is out there on the open market. I mean, European firms, even Russian firms, are selling, you know, the older, not the latest, but, you know, still very good thermals. I mean, the thermals first came into their own, you know, back in the 91 war. And then they kept getting better and better and better. But there are decent thermals that'll give you a picture out to 1,000 meters. which obviously is not as good as the ones now, which can go out a couple thousand meters. But for the Iraqis, you know, this is light years ahead of what any of their tankers have ever seen. And most importantly, it's light years ahead of anything the Iranians have.
Right.
Their main concern.
Well, that's, look, the whole point, they got it, they got an overmatch against their real threat, and it's, let me make a point about this in the Iraqi military. Jim talks about the corruption, about corruption which saps that country. Too bad. You think about what it could be and what the opportunity it's got. And as you can see in our strategy page reports, the corruption issue is really far more worrisome than any other one that in particular, including Iranian intrigue. If I would say that, I think that's what would the Iranians exploit. The Iraqi army has some good units now. And I mean, good in its ability to, their ability to carry out mobile operations. We saw that in 2008 with, what was it, Operation Night's Charge? Charge
yes,
of the Knights,
in Basra, yeah.
In late March, April 2008. A rather sophisticated two-division-plus operation in Basra, and you know, we got enough data on it to see how they had planned it, moved it, and I looked at it from a operational plans perspective. It was good, and they executed it. So they've got this developing cadre with what amounts to their I forget what Jim you call it, but it's like a rapid reaction force. I mean, it's their better divisions. They're on their way to building what I called in a Weekly Standard article I wrote right after I came back from Iraq, ran in early 2005, the Iraqi Bulldog. Now, the M1A1 would be part of that Iraqi Bulldog. And the F-16, just for full disclosure here, this is an aside, was last September 11th, 2009, Omar al-Adawi and I had an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about how the Iraqi Air Force needed F-16s, and some Patriots would be a good idea as well. Now, Jim's laid out the problem with the Patriots. It's my understanding now they are in the acquisition phase of some very basic F-16 models, and the Iraqi pilots want F-16s. They don't want MiGs. But to get back to the point about the quote-unquote Iraqi Bulldog, that is a genuine in-the-hall term from Al-Fall Palace. I remember talking with another senior ops and plans officer about what an Iraqi army might look like, and we said 2012, 2014, so we were looking a decade out from 2004, eight to ten years. And the what if this cadre, this smaller force, and I don't remember, I think we said four divisions, five divisions, is armed with U.S. type weapons, Western weapons, covered with the U.S. Air Force, but if not the U.S. Air Force, we're upgrading the Iraqi Air Force. Suddenly, you have got a predominantly, not solely, Arab army, it's Kurdish as well, with a degree of operational sophistication, more reliable weapons, and they have a punch that is a real challenge to the Iranians. And the reason I called it a bulldog is that it'd be like a little bulldog. The only thing you're going to be that's going to hold that little bulldog is the United States and Iraq's Western allies, include Great Britain and Australia as well. So don't do it.
But you know what's funny? The irony of this is that the situation in Iran is such that the population would never stand for another war with Iraq.
Oh, I understand that.
In other words,
I'm not saying that the Iraqis, it is, I'm looking at the Iranian regime, Jim, and we've talked about this offline before. I don't think we've done it on strategy page, I mean on strategy talk here, but about why do the Iranians want the bomb? Well, there's prestige and talk and the like, but they turn around and they are afraid of a revitalized an emerging democratic Iraq. It hits them on all cylinders is what it does the most. And that the
well, they also want an easy, They also want an easier way to settle their real estate disputes with Arab countries.
Oh, absolutely. But then who's the big Arab country they got disputes with?
Yeah. Well, no, they have to, I don't know if we've run this piece yet, but there's a piece on Bahrain where more Iranians are talking about Bahrain as the 14th province, the lost province, you know, just like the Iraqis with Kuwait in the 19th province. And the Bahrainians are apparently, you know, hitting the roof over this. They're arresting Shia activists right and left. But funnily enough, they're not blaming Iran, covering their bets. But they're making it clear that, you know, Bahrainian Shia seeking a regime change is not going to happen. They leave little to the imagination as to who they think is behind it. And this is something, you know, Iran has been doing, or at least the Al-Quds force, you know, inside Iran, their little special forces, secret police, have been stirring up trouble in the neighboring Arab countries with Shia minorities, you know, increasingly over the last decade. And of course, Bahrain is one of the few countries besides Iran that has a Shia majority. That's 70% of the population Shia, although a Sunni monarchy, you know, runs the place. But there are no Saddams down in Bahrain, but there are some very nervous Sunnis.
Well, look, they make trouble for predominantly Sunni Persian Gulf nations as well. Look at UAE, United Arab Emirates. That's a Sunni that they, the Iranians spar with them over those islands out in the Persian Gulf,
which is a big deal to the Arabs. I mean, the islands are nothing, really. But, you know, it's become a point of honor, as it were. Given half a chance, you know, the UAE would go to war over them. But, you know, Iran
is... You know, there really is a deep strategic point with that. Those islands, you know, you can say honor, but also if you let them take that, then you're acceding in a certain, you know, I think in a real political way, Iranian control over the strait. And
that's true.
They only have half. You guys got a claim to your side, but it's Oman and the UAE on the other side. And why should we give in to your bullying? Because then you come up and the next Iranian claim is the Straits Ayers. Well, I think they got a legitimate point on it. Are we going to get back to Iraq?
Right. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk about,
by the way.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk about, Austin, was your latest article on Point on Strategy Page and your syndicated column about what the feelings of the Iraqis are about all the changes that have happened and how that's affecting the current administration.
Well, look, there have been a number of polls conducted by the Iraqi people. Really since 2003 and Saddam toppled. And I commented at the time, here you go. Now they've got an opportunity to speak their minds, the Iraqi people, and the odds are they're not going to go to jail. Now, it's still a tough scrap because you've got Arabs are wont to say the gun to the head. If you say too much, the extremists, the radicals, the terrorists will also kill you, as well as the tyrants. And that's when I talk about the terrible yin yang of afflicting predominantly Arab Muslim states. You know, they're caught between tyrant and terrorist, and there's really little difference in terms of shooting your mouth off. Just to give the root of that, an Arab friend of mine used that in the early 80s, a guy I was going to school with in Germany to talk about the situation in his particular home country in terms of expressing differing political opinions with the regime that was controlling his country. But he said the same thing applies for extremists. Well, so I started polling in Iraq, and you can see all kinds of tracks of different polls. But since really 2006, when the Maliki government finally stands up, which is May of 2006, you start saying, tracking a little bit more on public opinion, in part because the government cares what public opinion is. And in August, this is prior to President Obama's August 31st speech, a sophisticated kind of poll that we get here in the United States, tracking voter sentiment. And again, that's a remarkable change. Voter sentiment in Iraq, just step back and think about it, came up, and the numbers off the top of my head, I believe it was 60%, actual number in the article I read, may have been 61%, reporting on it was of the respondents, and again, you know, this was a large poll with a statistically significant number of people, said that the United States was ending its combat mission too quickly. That was a perception. A significant plurality, and a very divided one on this. I think it was 42% said that they didn't think President Obama cared about Iraq. Right below it, 40%, 39% said that they thought he did care. So, but you have a division there, and this was a poll set up to make sure it got a representative sample of a very complex country. And what you've got there is a view, and this is what I wrote in my syndicated column, was that President Obama has got a political problem with Iraqis. It's very divided opinion. It's easy to make this next step. There's a substantial number of Iraqis don't trust him to fulfill his commitment, and I am glad, so this doesn't sound like an attack on President Obama, I'm glad that he said a couple of things, or a couple of paragraphs in that speech of August 31st that I agree with. I'm glad he did it, in reassuring the Iraqis that the United States would be there to support them. For what it's worth, Omar al-Adawi and I did another Wall Street Journal piece on August 4th that asked him, the president, to say that, and I can only applaud him for taking, making a statement pretty close to what Omar and I had hoped. Now, here's why. Is that that poll that I just discussed, really, it put some quantitative, it put some numbers, statistics, on something that I've noticed out of the Iraqi press really over the last 2 years, Dan. It's I think I said months in the article, because in part I referred to a really instructive essay that ran in the Arab newspaper, very respected one, unbiased one, Ashraq al-Assad. It ran on May 16th, and the columnist basically said that he thought, and he was reflecting the thinking of other Iraqi Arabs, that President Obama just wanted to be done, to escape from the situation in Iraq. Except there's no escape, is what he said. And it was a very well done and elegant column reflecting what I've seen out of the Iraqi press over the last couple of years. And I get some very good summaries, and in some cases detailed translations, the Iraqi press, from a email source I subscribe to, have for several years. By the way, some of that background on that you certainly see reflected in my columns and some of the things we discuss on strategy page. And just to make another major point, the fact that there is a free press in Iraq, and it's a very lively one, robust, highly critical. Again, one of my Arab colleagues, Omar al-Adawi, follows it very closely. He's a Baghdadi. And he says, we've got a really strong free press here now. The politicians are just treated scathingly, and they are.
Yeah, but it's free. It's free like the British press is free. And that, the more outrageous, the story, the more papers you're going to sell.
Well, there is a Fleet Street component to it, Jim. I agree. But the thing is, it's really different than it was under Saddam.
You can say outrageous things without getting shot.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you still might get shot, but not as certainly.
Exactly. So the point I made in that is that a trust and confidence and Iraqi confidence, the Iraqi people's confidence, is what has carried them through the terrible fight that they've had so far. And I think we, on Strategy Page, believed it began to turn really in 2005. And we're ahead of the surge, watching at least the way that our opinion about Al Qaeda had really shifted, and about some of the old hardline Saddamist Ba'athists. They weren't coming back after Saddam was captured, and then they definitely weren't coming back after Saddam was executed. That's late 2006, but. They need the confidence, the Iraqi people, to carry them through so that they are an emerging democracy. They're
right.
Having to figure out what a democratic country is in their situation and in their part of the world. And they need the support of the United States as a reliable ally. And my column on the opinion part of it, President Obama is caught between what he said as a candidate. We all know what he said. We all know who he was aligned with, Harry Reid. And I do damn Senator Reid. You know, the war in Iraq is lost, he declared in April of 2007. That's utter falsehood, complete falsehood. So President Obama is caught between his own party's base. Completely, you know, they take Iraq and pull it out of the global war on terror, and it's just a unique battle, the way they frame it, a unique war, and it's all Bush's fault. Well, I think that is strategically naive that it's strategically wrong to try to isolate Iraq like that. But Obama had, and he's caught between his past and a present that is really dramatically different than the way he framed the issue. And that's what that column was about.
Yeah, there's also something else that doesn't get covered at all. And that's what the Sunni Iraqis are thinking. And the thing I've been getting a bit more from my sources is now they're talking about Plan C. You know, Plan B was the terror campaign. Plan C, which we've mentioned before, is basically, let's just wait until the Shia and Kurdish morons completely screwed up, and then we'll just walk right in like we've done in the past and take over. Now, Shia and Kurds are going to be nervous for a long time about letting Sunnis get anywhere near, you know, the Interior Ministry or the Defense Ministry. Because the last time the Sunnis took over in the 50s, they did it because they held senior positions in the military. So, you know, this is something all Iraqis know but don't like to talk about because they've been there before and they don't want to go back.
Right. Well, it sounds like things will continue to be interesting there, much more on the internal basis of what's going on with their internal politics and like that. Hopefully we can continue to train up their troops and get them to a point where we can even withdraw more. Now, the truth of the matter is that we will probably have troops there for a long, long time, right?
That's what's being, you know, discussed now. There'll probably be a great to-do about, hey, we're all gone by the end of 1911, except for a few technical people. And you're right.
I think it's going to be several thousand technical people within
right.
16s and M4s.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, though, is if the Iraqis go through with this F-16, which is a plane that makes a heck of a lot of sense for them, for a lot of reasons. Because they've got other Arab states that fly it, the Turks fly it.
Well, they've actually started training Iraqi pilots. We did report on that.
I know that.
The first gang of pilots. And I think it's almost a done deal. I don't know what's holding it up. Maybe about, you know, who exactly is going to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. But I completely agree. It's the ideal aircraft for them.
One of the rumors is that some of at least the initial ones are going to be cascaded to them from a NATO source. I don't know who that could be, but there are all kinds of
Well, there are several NATO countries that are still trying to unload their Cold War surplus F-16s and Leopard tanks.
Their F-16s?
Sure. There's no shortage of... Yeah, well, the Dutch and the Belgians and the Danes have all been unloading secondhand F-16s.
All right, that could be where the rumor comes from, but there are sources that got them, they started them, and my point is they're going to have U.S. Air Force technical assistance at some level to bring their Air Force up to snuff.
Right.
Or they can just go up to Europe and hire the civilians who used to maintain the NATO F-16s. Hey, you guys
sure,
want to work again?
That.
You know, with the sunshine and you know lots of nice weather and fortified bases for you to live in.
Mm-hmm. make a nice paycheck.
Right. Well, we've run out of time, gentlemen. It was good to hear your perspectives on Iraq, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it again.
Indeed.
Yep. We'll see you.
Take care, Dan.
Bye.